around his every year.
Dr. Claude C.L.A.U.D. Anderson, aide to Governor Reuben Askew, Tallahassee, May 16th, 1974.
He looks in good shape. Close contact. After that, we're gone. I'm not concerned about what's politically expedient or politically advantageous. And that's what he's always done. It's very easy to advise and work with him, because he's never gonna play the games with him.
You said he asks basically what's right and he does it.
Yeah. A few times he said, "Well, I tell you, the rumor says, you know, 2 and 2 is really 4, but you know, on one side, if you say it's, you know, it's best to say 3 because Republicans are going to want you to say 3, and the Democrats are going to try to, since they're their buddies, and they want to get an extra point, they're going to want you to say 5. But in a real sense, based on the best information that's available to me, it's 4. And he's always going to go that way. And it's made it easy also for some of his opponents, in one sense of the word, because they've always expected him to come right down the center of the road on every issue. And they sit on the banks and take pot shots at him, you know. But somehow, for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe Providence watched over him. And I've always tried to encourage him to get a little more Machiavellian, which he won't do. But that's one little sign I got there now. I've given him books on the Prince.
Oh, really?
See right over here there. And that's one of the favorite women, that's our little philosophy, is to always stand up for what you think is right, regardless of what the consequences are. And he's always done that, and for that reason, particularly like on the busing issue, when he asked me, you know, what I thought about the busing issue, you know, in the real sense, you know, I said, well, to me, it's just a cold word for anti-black. He said, okay, let's go. So he jumps out, and he became the only politician in this country, black or white, that openly campaigned for busing for 3 solid months until he had to be put to bed by medical order. And I said, I don't think it'll get you in the long run. I said, in the long run, politically, it'll kill you. But I said, at least you'll sleep late, and one day, maybe even history will vindicate you. So,
well, how does he defy all the conventional wisdom and still come out on top?
I don't know.
all you politicians or Machiavellians are telling him to go down the middle, and he doesn't do it.
I don't know how he does it, but every time an issue comes up, I guess it's a common, it's sort of an ideology, I don't know, maybe it's the ingredients. He's a very strongly religious man, and he tries to practice his religion, particularly in that area of social contact and social endeavors and human contact. So that makes him, I guess, in a real sense, politically, it makes him a liberal, in the sense that he's extremely concerned about human beings. And so they tag him with the label of being a liberal governor in the furthest state in the South. On the other hand, though, you talk about money matters, he came from a very poor white rural family out here, and he's sort of an ultra-conservative on money. So when he inherited his administration from the Republicans, he was $300 million in the red, and within 1 year, he was $300 million surplus.
And have you been with him since he took office?
Just about a few months after.
Okay, you grew up in Detroit, right?
From 16 upward, I did. Prior to that, I spent my first 16 years in the South.
Where?
Been pretty well split. North Carolina, and foothills, Piedmont country. So I guess I'm an admixture on both sides.
Where in North Carolina?
Winston-Salem. I put in half my life in the South and half in the North. Right now I'm a northern boy in the Southern system.
And you went to college and graduate school where?
Variety, but my latter programs at Wayne State University.
And you came back South, meaning in this case to Florida, when?
In 1970. In June of 70.
And when did you join Askew?
I guess it's been 3 years. How many years has I been on the staff? I've been in Florida 4 years.
You said you've been on here almost since the beginning, which would be 71.
Yeah, no, I didn't come on in 71 then.
Well, he actually took office in 71.
Yeah, he took office in January or September. Well, I'm trying to remember because of the difference between.
But you had just come to Florida.
Yeah, I've been in Florida I took office about 6 months after his initiation into the office.
And you'd only been in Florida about a year.
Just about a year then.
How did you come to his attention? If I may express it in those terms.
Let's get back to this again. I got involved in a lot of little local problems.
In Tallahassee.
Being a student of social scientists, I was particularly curious at the fact that there was a political gap that exists between the North and the South as far as handling problems and the way they dealt with issues. And as I said, I felt that the South was much more parochial in the sense that they still pretty much hung out, as I said, the best way I can express that, the old barbershop signs, you know, and whenever an issue came up, they didn't mind coming out and tell you what they were going to do. The North has always been much more glib and much more sophisticated in what they did, much more polished in that sense. South right now is going through sort of withdrawal, particularly if you talk about racial issues, for instance. They're going through withdrawal pain. They haven't quite yet recuperated from the shock of desegregation or integration. They're beginning to pick up momentum again, beginning to pick up some of the sophistication of the North, but right now they're not very good at that. And so in most confrontations, you can just about catch them with their pants down.
You got what, a doctorate in psychology?
Educational sociology.
But how did you first meet Askew?
He invited me up to join his administration after the final little episode. I had one of the local school superintendents. At that time, I wrote a grant for Florida A&M University for the Black Institution, which amounted to something about $1.5 million, and there was a very strong opposition to that because they wanted to go to the predominantly white institution. At that time, the local people did, at least the local, some of the local school administrators. And so we got involved in a long confrontation over that that went on for about over a 2 or 3 month period. And I guess in the end, the final analysis, I came out rather victorious in the sense that he was proven to be the liar. And subsequent to that, some other people entered the race to fight him to run against him for the new election. He lost and some other things. And after that, the governor asked me to come down and to join his administration because the previous person had a position was under the Republican, Kirk. And this office has only been in existence for a very short period of time. I guess maybe about 4 or 5 years old. It's not very an old job. And this position is the only one of its kind in the country. We are one of the few states, not the only state, that has what you call a cabinet system. Are you familiar with that?
Right.
And which means that the governor is basically on his own. He has very little statutory or regulatory control over those other areas, particularly, for instance, education, because the Commissioner of Education, regulation-wise, is the chief state school officer. And he doesn't have to exhibit any identification or commitment to the governor if he doesn't wish to, because he runs statewide with his own political constituency. And so between him and the commissioner, there has to be an individual to keep the governor properly informed and make in educational directions, that is, and programs, and that becomes my responsibility, which in Michigan you would have something like John Porter as a superintendent of education, and you have your governor. But here, this position is somewhere between there. It's not like most of the other executive aides to the governors who I know. Their function is still different because they can still depend on those agencies. Here we can't. Those are political adversaries, and we can't pretend that. So we have to develop not only watch the programs programmatically, but politically too. You have to be tuned into every issue that takes place.
But one thing I'm not clear on yet. Did you just suddenly get a call out of the blue one day saying, "This is Reuben Askew, and I want you to join my administration"? You'd never met, or he had never talked to you? Or?
No, the person had a position then. There were a group of them. They were concerned about getting a replacement for him. At that time, one of Reuben's philosophies was that he wanted, for instance, to make sure that in every position possible, board-wise, committee-wise, commission-wise, and even staff-wise, that a black be on the board or be identified. And he wanted to put a black in his administration someplace, and that was a position that was becoming open at that came open at that time because Bill Malloy, Dr. Malloy, was leaving and going to the Education Commission, which was a Citizens Committee for Education.
Oh, was Malloy black?
No, he was white. I was the first black. So I was the first black, I guess, that came to come into this in this position, period.
Are you the first black to be in the executive office?
Yes.
So do you, in effect, wear two hats?
Since Reconstruction, I believe.
Do you, in effect, wear two hats as the governor's primary advisor on education matters and primary advisor on matters dealing with blacks?
Yes, the latter one, the first one by professional commitment and obligation, second one much more by cosmetic commitment and interest. There are other people who you could probably get that input from, but I just give them that not because see first if those were in reverse orders I wouldn't take the job, I would not come on board for him to make me a special advisor for minority group affairs, because I would find that insulted first of all professionally and intellectually. But now if he tells me he's bringing me on in a mainline responsibility, which is to be his advisor, his coordinator for education throughout the state of Florida. And to be immediately concerned with those areas. Then, in addition, if I wished, you know, if I wanted to assume any responsibility about Sodom, I just got a call from Fort Lauderdale just now. They got a racial problem down in the high school. It's a little fighting. That if I also wish to have some carryover responsibility there that I may wish to, if I wish to, I can have it. That's different. But now, if I look at the Joint Center reports, for instance, now, of all the black executives on all these executive staffs in the United States, all of them sitting there in those kind of positions, what I consider to be, rather functory. It is for a black to be in a special assistant to the governor on audiovisual aids, or on a special assistant to the on minority group affairs. I wouldn't want that. And I don't think it's very challenging.
What sort of roles are you taking in this little Fort Lauderdale thing? Any?
Yes. Two things. First of all, I think that my own personal commitment for the fact that I got that my father's side of his family is white and mother's side is black, I think I can at least understand what both sides are really talking about. A bit above and beyond any professional feelings about it. So what I do then is to try to get both sides of the local issue too. I would immediately get on the phone, for instance, and request reports from the established agencies there, such as the law enforcement agencies that were involved. I want official reports from them. I want official reports from the school personnel. Sometimes I even call them on the phone, sometimes I make it written. If they don't send it, then I threaten to subpoena it. If necessary, I'll make them work overnight, or we can, just as long as I get it there, to make sure that let them know that that someone else is involved. So what I'm saying before I get into giving you actual mechanics, what I would do is that my philosophy is that I don't permit vacuums to be created in those situations. That as soon as possible, because if you let a vacuum exist, you get a demagogue that'll fill it one way or the other real quick like. So I try as much as possible to get everybody actively involved in trying to solve the issue and let them know that at the local level there's some people up here that are extremely concerned about the issue being solved. Then get reports from all the established agencies. On the other hand, if it's a minority group, whether it's the Spanish Americans or Cubans or the migrants or the blacks, on their side you have to try to get other agencies to do it for you. See, we have what's known as a Human Relations Commission, and I'll call them on the phone and tell them to get a couple of field workers on there as soon as possible to try to get me an objective report, particularly from the minority group side. Because they have very poor communications, and that's usually the problem. And usually if I wait too long, we have a few demagogues in Florida, some black militants who are there, fill it just like that. And once that happens, then the sore festers, and we really got problems. We have a task force team over in the Department of Education. Usually I'll ask that, you know, that they contact a local school that's involved and sort of suggest that they officially request that they come in and assist them in solving the problem.
Is this a task force team dealing specifically with these kind of problems?
Yeah, They deal specifically with those problems, racial problems or human relations kind of problems. But the only drawback is that they have to be requested to come in. That makes it rather difficult. So you have to start
By the local school board?
Yeah.
And that's
the problem, because that's almost asking the same people involved the problem to come in, invite you back in. See, what we ideally need is someone you can just send in there right off the bat. You can't do that.
But you yourself don't have any hesitation about taking an initiative on that kind of situation?
No, because the governor ain't going to ask. He's not going to tell you nothing. You're on your own. The first day he hired me, you know, I've had absolutely no experience in running state government at all. And so he said, I didn't ask you for anything. He said, you're going to do the same thing I do. He said, then make your mistakes like I do. This is my first time being governor, so you're on your own. See you.
How often do you see him?
About, under normal circumstances, maybe about 3 times a week.
Is this usually in a one-to-one situation or a staff meeting?
That's a combination. So I have to see him for press briefings, I have to see him for cabinet briefings. Again, I have to give him a sort of a script as to what he's to do in the cabinet sessions for each issue that comes up, how he's to vote, and why he's to vote that way, and explain the issue to him. Also, the same thing is true with the cabinet briefings. In addition to that, there are a lot of personal crises that come in that's going on all the time that I have to report to him on. Whether it's political in nature, straight across the board, because I have a lot of little information sources that feed me information. I have to keep him briefed on that. I send him little monthly reports, itemized reports on what all the minority groups and what all the blacks are up to, what all the organizations are doing, how he's to deal with them. If one comes out in the paper and says he's not doing a damn thing for blacks, why don't he pick the point of black judge? I have to provide him with a response to that, how he's responding to it, or whether he's responded at all. Or like this week, now he's speaking before the Florida Voters League, which is a black, or State Florida Voters League, which is a black organization, about 400 people to be here. So writing speeches for his response, I know what they're after, so I have to try to make sure I get it in the speech, because what they want after is to have a question and answer session with him. So I've tried as much as possible to make sure that doesn't occur, and yet satisfy both the people who are going to be there and protect him.
When do they meet?
Saturday morning.
Here?
No, they're going to be at the Holiday Inn Saturday morning.
Meet in Tallahassee?
Yes.
The downtown one or the other one?
Tell you the truth, I don't even know where it is now. Let's see.
I don't even know which one it is. I've got Holiday Inn, I have to check.
It's one of them.
Is that the most effective statewide black political organization?
Oh.
It is statewide, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's a good question. I don't really know. Because along with one of my first comments to you was the fact that, you know, in its form of an observation, was that I felt that the political situation a little archaic here, pretty parochial. Well, it's even more parochial with the blacks here. Blacks in Florida, I think, are probably the most disorganized blacks in the state, in the country. You find, in fact, if you were to take Florida, pick Florida up, and you can impose Florida over the United States and parallel it to, superimpose one, you could superimpose Florida over the country. You want something right on?
I've got it.
You could probably superimpose Florida over the country and probably find it pretty well matches, almost identical to the various stratus of attitudes in this country. In northern Florida, for instance, pretty much like southern United States, and mid Florida is pretty much like mid United States, and lower Florida is pretty much like northern United States. And blacks tend to flow attitudinally along the same lines. Up along the panhandle, which is the northern part, blacks in this area are extremely backwards in every sense of the word. And they're pretty much like a picture out of the old 20 days. If you're, very little has changed. Time has almost bypassed them. And they are pretty much, they're pretty much dependent on the independent farms and plantations up there. And they probably, they still pretty much follow guidelines and dictates. Lower part of Florida, blacks down there aren't too active for the simple fact they tend to very much believe what a lot of the more progressive liberals out of the north tell them, that there are no problems. So those who make contact with the big money people down in, along those areas, they tell us, look, you know, we're all equal, there are no problems, so you shouldn't even be involved in those issues. So they're not very active. So we don't have that many active blacks in the state of Florida. There's a leadership vacuum for blacks in Florida. And for that reason, the NAACP cut Florida off. Florida is sort of disaffiliated with the national NAACP, and that's about the biggest organization of mine. It was the NAACP, but they have no national connections. The Urban League is about, that's not very strong either. They are active, but they don't, Urban League doesn't get into politics anyway, so you can't count them. You have the Black African, you have the African Socialist Party down in the middle state. They get active once in a while. What you have in Florida is a few people, once you have about six people to be exact, from the lower part up, blacks from the lower part up, that tend to be self-aggrandized spokesmen. There are two or three of them, I know, they pick up the paper like this and go through the paper every day and circle a few issues, and they go run to the press and get a little press coverage out of it. They never follow up on it. And
how about the Voters League?
The Voters League is for people that I think are genuinely interested, but they're handicapped for two reasons. They're handicapped and therefore not too effective, because they don't have proper information upon which to make decisions about any issue on. And secondly, that deficit of information is based on the fact they don't know how to play politics. They don't know how to make contacts and get information. For instance, I guess I'm about the highest black in state government, and they've never called me once. Most of the blacks in the state don't call you. They won't call you for any information. And so they never know what's going on. And the last part, the difficulty comes from the fact that you got a lot of black, old-line blacks that belong to those parties, who are ultra-conservatives, because they still pretty much function with a plantation mentality, which in this area, which says that only one black should be commissioned to make contact with the white power structure. The rest of y'all stay out in the field and keep busy. And that's the problem with the Florida Indian University, for instance. The president, he's going to run a plantation rather than a campus, and he's not going to let the rest of them come downtown and get involved in the issues and find out what's going on. He'll come downtown, he's going to go right to those sources who are directly above him. And once they snoop him and do him in, he wouldn't dare come check and ask elsewhere for diversity of information. And so those groups, so therefore, you find, for instance, in the upcoming election, you're going to find the old-line conservative blacks that I'm talking about, the plantation ones, they're going to be representing all the ultra-conservatives and some of the more radicals and racists in the states. See, it's the easiest thing to do, come in this part of the state, and George Wallace will come out here and pick up three or four blacks like that to represent him any place he wants to. As a matter of fact, that during the Democratic Convention, he picked up Jones to be responsible for the 15 black delegates he had. And you know Julian Bond, don't you? And Julian Bond came over just to talk to the black delegates, try to convince them to switch and vote the other way. Jones jumped on Julian Bond's back.
Who is Jones?
He's a little local jackleg politician around this, down around the Tampa area.
This is the Florida black delegates or the Alabama black delegates?
These are the Florida black delegates. Well, they weren't black, in the sense that they were a set-aside group, but they had the quota system. Democratic Convention, which we could have so many of all minorities involved, and we had some blacks in the group. And Junior Bond wanted to approach them about it. And this guy jumped on Junior Bond's back, started wrestling at the Democratic Convention about, don't touch these blacks belong to me and Wallace.
Were they bound to Wallace because of the primary vote?
Yeah, I think on the first couple of ballots, either the first or second ballots, I think after that you're free. I see Jones didn't want him to get free one way or the other. He wanted to keep him bound up to Wallace. And right now, see, there are a couple of blacks already out who are campaigning for Adams and that group, and the people who are opposed to the governor. And you know, their platform is ultra-conservatism. These guys are going to profit, because what they want is that they just want to make a profit for themselves and for the rest of their people, they can shoot them down to two.
How many black legislators are there now?
Three. That's why we only have three. And that's why you go up in Georgia, you might find about 23. Or Alabama, about 23.
Well, you don't have single member districts here, though, am I correct?
That's right. See that chart behind you? That's a suit that I served in the Supreme Court against the reapportionment. That's the way the reapportionment was broken up like that. Every black district in the state was gerrymandered. I lost in Supreme Court 4-3. See, all this orange part up here. Really, if you the marks don't really mean anything. Just it's indicative of where there's heavy concentration of blacks. Blacks is about to have a whole band all the way across here, from here all the way across here. For black to justify a district of 29,000 people.
And you carried that, you say, into the court? State Supreme Court or U.S. Supreme Court?
I'd ask some other, I had some black lawyers to take it into the federal court, but you know, they weren't too enthused over it. I told them, what the hell, you know, I'm not gonna worry about it, carry everybody's problems.
When was that suit?
It was back during the time of the reapportionment. I'm not sure when that was. It must be about two years or so ago.
While you were in the governor's office.
Uh-huh. Well, he ain't gonna say that. He just said, his whole philosophy is do what you think is right for your people. But that's why you won't find it. That's why right now, that's still 1840 up there. See, a year ago, the governor had to go up there and make them take the law books out. And that place, one area where 10 is right there, right? 10, coming down through Quincy there with Quincy. Quincy is 70, that area is 71-72% black. They wouldn't even permit blacks not only to register up there or to vote, they wouldn't even permit them to register. There's a suit right now to make them let blacks sit on jury duty. Don't let them hold public office or nothing else. Won't even let them work anywhere around state government. As a matter of fact, the governors, they've been hiding the registration books in the back of the newspaper office and locking them up. They bring them out the day before election. But you know, but if you haven't registered that day before, though, you can't vote.
Is this a one county problem, so to speak?
Well, no, the counties get different schemes. That's a study right there that I had conducted to find out how to get more blacks on the various school boards. We have 67 school districts in the state of Florida, and we've had three blacks elected to 67 counties. We got six school board members all together, and the governor appointed three of those, so half of them are appointed by the governor. And
you're saying that there are places in Florida where it's still difficult for blacks to register to vote?
Well, yeah. You know, you get there because of the schemes that go on. The schemes are they're very crude schemes. They're not polished schemes, but they make up for the crudeness with outright oppression. See, I can take every in those areas, and most of them, the blacks that do vote, see, legitimately, they show up on the registrar as being registered voters, and they do vote. But see, most of them, for instance, the household servants, see, they're driven down there, and they're told that, you know, that if you vote the wrong way, you won't have a job tomorrow, or that we got all kinds of ways to determine how you vote and how to count the votes. And that's why I can go there right now, and the black vote almost solidly for Wallace and for the biggest races in the country. A black just ran up there for mayor. Blacks outnumbered the whites there 4-1. It was a black-white issue. For the election, when the ballots were counted, the white got twice as many votes as the black did. So he can keep them back, so he can put them back where they were in the beginning. And the little schemes show up like here in this district. Now in this scheme, I tried to come up with a better way. The better way, according to the computer, was that it go to single-man district. According to mathematical projection based on a computer scheme, I can almost ensure 6 to 7 blacks being elected in the state of Florida to school boards if went to single man districts. But see, they're not gonna let you go to single man districts. Because see, the politicians who want to play king of the mountain know that. Same ones that set up these other little schemes. So when you look, so what happens is that the politics is run by those, by the crooks in office, or the people, the schemers. They aren't going to see the system. What I'm saying to you is that we live in a very homicidal system, and yet that the federal government, in its non-wise ways, asked the local districts to do their own apportionments, and they're going to, being homicidal, they're not suicidal. They're not going to cut their own throats. They cut the throat of the most common victim, and that's what happens. So it keeps going on and on and on. So, but you, the single man districts would get some of them elected.
The Human Relations Commission, was that in operation before Askew became governor? Was that a Kirk creation or?
I don't really know. I think that I got a feel that came out. Let's see. I think that came out of I don't really know. I'm not going to answer that, but I might give you some misleading information. I don't want to answer that too much here. Because when I first got here, we were trying to get it started then, so it couldn't have been too old. But I was, as I said, I was 6 months coming on board. It could have been, I came on right after the legislative session, and it could have been enacted that during that legislative session, so I don't want to answer.
Do you know the blacks that have been appointed in the other executive offices in 11 southern states?
Do I know who they are?
Yeah, you know most of them.
I know them by, I have the names of them.
Do you know them by position? Is your position relatively higher than theirs? Function. I'm not talking about community relations or human affairs. Or
yes, in that regard, yes. Because there's a mostly non-line jobs. For instance, in the state of Florida, our largest budget, 70% of the budget is education. This is the largest single segment of state government right here.
How much input do you have in writing the budget?
Very little, by and large. That's because we don't have the expertise again. That's done by the Department of Administration.
How about this proposed, as I understand it, don't know if we've been here 2 days, but this is it a proposed 2 mil tax decrease on education, or decrease from 10 to 8 mils as the maximum limit?
The cap. Yeah, he's trying to run back the cap from 10 to around 8.
The cap is what?
Yeah, trying to roll the cap back.
What is a cap?
Which means that's the highest that the local states could charge for ad valorem tax. Various counties around the state. So what that's trying to do, again, and probably Marshall, probably, I'd have an assistant Marshall. Marshall works with finance. That's his primary thing with the office. He works with finance. Marshall can probably explain that to you much better than I could. I took the class at Wayne, and I never really understand it well. But what it does, well, is trying to give some relief to the local levels. And since you can't, which means, in a sense, it's going to mean a reduction for the local property tax owner. But here again, but they get caught again, though, because we also try to standardize assessments all over the state. See, for instance, in the property was being assessed in Tallahassee now at about 64% of its value, when Miami was being assessed at about 95% of its value, which meant in a sense that people in Miami were putting more money into the pot than people in Tallahassee were putting. So we try to take over, based again on the Rodriguez decision, that kind of business, trying to say that, you know, we're going to start talking about equal educational opportunity. It should go across the board all the way.
So what is it now? Is it now 100%?
Well, that's what we're going to do. They want everybody to assess straight out on a standardized basis.
Will it be 100% evaluation or lower percentage?
It's going to be less than 100. I think it'll be about 90-something. I'm not sure what it's going to be exactly.
Is there a statewide property tax?
All this is being debated now.
But is a statewide property tax?
No, what we're talking about is local ad valorem tax.
Right.
Okay. But see, local ad valorem tax have been differing to the point, let me show you the difference, that up in Gaston County, where I just told you about, where you had this heavy concentration of poor blacks, up there, they come out levying or at least allotting to the school district almost $200 per child because of the poor tax base up there. Where down in Glades County, they come out with $1,100 per child. So what we're trying to do is figure out how we can balance that thing to where it comes out all over the state at about $800 a child.
But the only way you could do that is increase the state share.
That's right. Right. So we're going to increase the state
share. So is there going to be a state ad valorem tax? So?
No. We're going to take the monies out of our coffers up here, and we're going to make the difference. We're just going to make the difference up in state monies. Okay. Again, see, the what I was telling you earlier, see, because that's Reuben's kind of attitude. He wants everything to be equal and fair. And he's trying to make sure that everybody gets as much for their dollar in one place as they do in another, and every child gets an equal opportunity across the board. If it means setting up standardization at the county level, fine. See, some counties say, well, we can't make it anyway. That's not enough money, so okay, we'll put money in the pot. So we're going to pour in the rest of the money to make up the difference once we cap them off.
Does the state set school teacher salary?
No, not really. Each county has that prerogative to set its own salaries.
Is there a state supplement?
Yes, they get monies, but the state doesn't exercise any authority over telling them how those monies to be spent. Like, we were on a unit system back a few years ago. We were putting in maybe $1,100 a unit, classroom unit. And maybe out of that unit, there were $400 of teacher salaries, let's say. Now, some of the districts gave teachers a whole $400, and some of them only gave them $200 of it. For instance, that's why in Miami, teacher salaries might be, let's say, for a five-year teacher, might be $1,100, $1,500. For a five-year teacher in Gaston County, it might be about $800. So when we started talking about the formula again, then we started saying, well, we'd try to build in cost differentials. We say, okay, fine, when we level off this whole process of education, who's going to get what money? Trying to make sure everybody gets an equal amount of money. Then somebody said, well, what about the difference between Gaston and Miami? Cost more to live in Miami. So then we have started talking about cost differential, the additional cost that it takes to live in that area.
You were talking before about one role you played in just giving the governor input and information you get, a lot of it political. Is that more or less a self-defined role, something you decided you just wanted to do in this job?
Mm-hmm. The governor, as I said, our governor and the staff is pretty free. And he has permitted just about everybody to be on their own. He's not going to tell you what to do, when you're going to do it, or anything. Where are you going to go?
There's no chief of staff?
Yes, but he's not going to do it either. See then? I might see the chief of staff less than I see the governor.
Are there regular staff meetings?
Yes, on a Monday morning. But all we do there is just everybody go around and just, you know, regurgitate or share whatever problems they might have that they want some other staff to sit in on. Other than that, you're on your own. See, nobody's going to come in and tell me, you know, say, well, you know, what are some of the problems you're having? So I got my own bills going through the legislature. I'm fighting for those. And I'm running to ourselves, racial problems. And I wrote the program for the affirmative action plan for the state, minority groups. I have to keep that going and take calls on that, try to help out with that. Stay on the backs of all the various division heads, secretaries, make sure that they're carrying out the mandates. Nobody else is going to come and help me do those things. Nobody can come see whether I'm doing it right or not.
How many senior staff are there?
Just one. And everybody just stays busy doing their own thing. You know, I guess the only freedom that I have that others have been to see is just, that's like the whole press conference. You see, most of the others have to go through the press section for a press release. And usually I got pretty much a free hand to do that. Something I don't like, I just chew out a person I don't like, and it goes on television. Well, then the governor tells you, sometimes you might say, well, I sure wish you hadn't said it at that time. for. You know, I wish you'd have waited until later. But he's never going to tell you that you're wrong. He said, well, that was a mistake.
Well,
you know, you'll wait.
Do other staff members come to you about minority problems?
Yeah, usually they come to you about them. They'll tell you about it.
Is the role you're playing, both professionally and as a black, is it what you expected when you took the job?
Yeah. No, not. You may be honest with you?
Yeah.
Not really, because I didn't think I'd be able to do the job. Let me be honest with you. Looking at the job description, I didn't think I would last 2 minutes. I didn't have the least, you know, notion that I could serve in that function. You know, to pick up the telephone and call Governor Don in Tennessee and be able to talk with him and carry on programs, and turn around and call HEW, tell him our position on various issues, or talk with Carter and his staff, stuff like that, or go out and meet. Go to the governor's, Southern Governor's Conference and deal with them. I never had, you know, because I used to get uptight, but now, you know, it doesn't bother me. I get a little willing. And I guess it's, you know, as you become acclimated to something, you adjust to it. And now I enjoy it pretty well. It's no problem.
You're saying you have your own bills in the legislature. Yeah. What would be an example of that?
An example? Okay, let's see.
So this is a report of the Governor's Task Force on Disruptive Youth.
Yeah. Okay, that's it. Okay, back, I guess about a year or so ago now, I was concerned, first of all, that in this state there were a heck of a lot of black kids, for instance, being thrown in the street, along with a lot of kids, period. And the reason, one reason why I love to pick the, I've always been a person that loved to identify with the underdog. And being, at that time, one of the few people in state government, and at one time the only black in state government, I found that nobody really looked out for the underdogs. And so I thought, that's why you asked me earlier, was that a professional responsibility? It's because nobody else was doing it. And the easiest thing in the world, you know, is to do is to pretend that certain people don't exist. And so I got concerned about what was happening to all those kids. And, you know, nationally it was a racial feeling, but above and beyond that, I was saying that you're really throwing the wrong people in the streets. You're throwing the people in the streets who can ill afford to be in the streets. And black kids, by God, can't afford one day out of school. And in check, so I asked the State Department of Education again, said, why don't you start looking into what's happening to those children? And I cannot believe that throwing children in the streets will solve problems.
This is basically the push-out problem.
Yeah. So what you're doing is just compounding their problems or postponing their problems or relieving yourself of their problems. And that you need to start doing something about the suspension and expulsion rate in this state. And so they said, well, we don't have no problem. That's no problem. Then I can sneak around and find, for instance, Brevard County, that in 1 month they put out 4,400 children. That concerns me. And I found that 3/4 of those are blacks. That concerned me even more. Then I look at the allegations, I even get more concerned. I find out that they're being put out for stuff like 300 being put out for vulgarity, 400 being put out for smoking, maybe another 500-600 being put out. As a matter of fact, the leading cause of expulsion and suspension in this state was truancy. And see, there's no way that you can educationally justify to me why you're throwing kids out of the street for truancy. And that's the leading cause in the state. And so after asking them, they said, no, we don't even have a problem. That's not a problem in the state of Florida. I said, okay, fine, then I'll make it a problem. So then I just called the Criminal Justice Council, told them, give me $60,000, and I assigned some people from the university to go out and conduct a study. I said, go find whether or not this problem does exist. They came back with that. And what they said was almost what I suspected in the beginning. The only difference was that the climax there was that the fact they found 50,000 kids were thrown out in the streets, and on a projected basis of 50,000. I checked with HEW in Washington, it came out to be exactly 87,000 or something that were put out in one state. In five states, five southern states, over 200,000 were put out last year. And so then I said about the business thing, first of all, I question whether or not you're violating those kids' rights of due process, putting them out, at least based on the Tinker and the Graff decision, which says you cannot justifiably throw a kid out of the street unless you've explored all other alternatives and substantially proved that his behavior disrupted the school day of school activities. And so then this year the bill that I wanted to build, for an example, is called Safe School, well, not Safe School, but that was last year, the Disruptive at School Act of 1974. And what the Disruptive School Act of 1974 is saying is that, first of all, you have to define all the terms. You have to define suspension and expulsions and all the other associated terms that you use. You have to define how long a kid can be out of school and his business, whether or not you can actually do it. It also says that in the bill that every kid entering a school must be provided with a Bill of Rights. He must be given a handbook telling him what his rights are. Because again, I was concerned that teachers and administrators could pull a kid into off to the side, and five adults could railroad a kid out of school. And to me, nobody can convince me that a kid has had due process when he's got five adults in the same building running him out of school. And when you throw a kid out of school and deprive him of an educational opportunity, then you've deprived him of life. He can't survive very well without it. And in this state, they were expelling kids like crazy. When they expel you, that means you don't come back for the rest of your life. And I was fine
getting... So you have a bill in the legislature that identified as the governor's bill?
No.
Identified as your bill?
No, what I do then in that case, you'd see in that one, for two reasons, I'd identify that. You don't do that for two reasons. To keep down the backlash. You get your workhorse administrator, your legislators to do that for you. Like in this case, Senator Graham is carrying that for me in the Senate, and Senator Nelson is carrying it in the House under Conway. And then let them carry it, because what they do is that, see, those, they get up here.
Is Graham the governor's floor leader?
He's one of the strong ones. See, those individuals who are very strongly identified with the office, usually we give them most of the pet bills.